Hello and welcome to the programme. You can visit our website anytime you like, rte.ie/Mooney. Today, Dr. Matthew Jebb introduces us to the May tree.
The hawthorn trees are in full bloom up and down the country, and traditionally, this is the tree that signifies the beginning of the summer months. A frost after the May tree has come out is incredibly unusual. So we can sort of rest comfortable now that the summer season is well underway, and the smell and the scale of the blossom of the hawthorn is a striking sight in every little roadway up and down the country.
We discover why some plant species are dominated by bumblebees, while others are dominated by honeybees.
So my name is Francis Ratniex. I'm Professor of Apiculture at the University of Sussex in southern England. So I study bees, and this particular project is on foraging of honeybees and bumblebees, and why it is that some flowers have mostly honeybees on them, and other species mostly bumblebees.
And whatever about Gene Kelly singing back in the day, all last week, outside my front door, it was a case of a blackbird singing in the rain.
Let the stormy clouds chase everyone from the place. Come on, sing along.
No, okay, we won't. Anyway, good evening. Very welcome to the programme. And what a busy show we have ahead of us today. Now, who would care about the rain when you've got that beautiful blackbird singing in the background? And I'm sure I'm not the only one to notice the blackbird was singing during and after the rain. What is it about singing in the rain? What's it all about? Anyway, we'll ask our panel. We'll start by saying hello to Richard Collins and Malahide and Niall Hatch and Grey Stones. Richard, it's been raining quite a lot all over the country this week. I'm sure you got a downpour in Malahide too. Was it welcomed?
Yes, Derek, and it is most welcome. The ground here has been rock hard now for a very long time, and the rain has come, and it takes a while to have effect because it's so hard, the ground, that the rain runs off it and escapes. But it's softening up fast, and the birds absolutely love it.
Oh, they would love it. Sure, they're able to get all the larvae and everything else.
Absolutely, they're having a ball.
Niall Hatch in Greystones. Niall, so I was playing there just a little clip of the blackbird that's been singing, sometimes on my roof, sometimes on my neighbour's roof, but always in the rain. The rain doesn't seem to affect the blackbird. And if you go to our website, rte.ie/Mooney, you'll see the worst photograph ever taken by anybody on the planet, by me, of this blackbird singing in the rain, because I took it with my phone. It was quite a distance away. But it was the only bird I noticed during the rainstorms, but it was piping away there at the very top of the roof.
Yes, blackbirds are well known for this. They're often associated with the rain or often singing just after the rain as well. And very few birds do this. And this is probably the secret and the reason why they do it, because they have the airways to themselves. When it's a nice sunny day, all the birds are singing. So they're competing to some degree with the song thrushes and with the robins and with the blackcaps and the blue tits and the wrens and all of these birds. And they do a good job of it and they have a good strong voice. But when it's raining, most of those other birds stop. And that means that the blackbird has this uninterrupted clear air that it can sing in, which will mean that its song will carry even further. It'll be more noticeable. It'll stand out more to potential rivals and to potential mates. And so that's the theory behind it as well. And of course, blackbirds, they are birds that do like the rain because it does soften up the ground. It makes it much easier for them to find worms. They can get through there when it's prolonged warm weather without any rain. What happens is, as Richard was saying, the ground gets very hard. And of course, blackbirds can't get down and get the worms they need for their chicks. It's harder, though, for birds that are mainly insect eaters, particularly birds like swallows and swifts that rely on flying insects, because when it's raining for a prolonged period, their chicks can actually starve because it's so hard for them to find food. So it swings and roundabouts. Some birds benefit and some don't, but the blackbird certainly is a bird that does like the rain.
Is there a danger of the feathers getting destroyed by all the water, Niall?
Feathers are the most remarkable things. They are wonderfully waterproof. They have these barbules on them that zip together and repel raindrops. And it used to be thought that this was because the birds put a special oil on their feathers that would naturally repel the water. But it seems that that oil they put on from this preen gland they have on their lower back, just near their tail, it seems that that actually just is more like hair conditioner, really. It conditions their feathers to keep them in good condition and makes them zip together properly. And it's the actual structure of the feather itself that repels the water. So that blackbird's skin is not getting wet. That water is just going off it like water off a duck's back or off a blackbird's back. It's the same process. It's obviously different for its chicks in the nest. They'll want to be well sheltered. So mum blackbird may well be sitting on the chicks or the eggs to make sure that they don't get chilled because they don't have the same level of protection. But the male himself, his job is to do the singing and to defend the territory. So he'll be nice and visible. He can go right out in the rain. And provided there isn't too much wind that might ruffle his feathers and cause the water to penetrate them, he'll be absolutely fine. He'll be dry as a bone.
Actually, one of the nicest things I ever saw in my life, and I mean this sincerely, is when we put a camera on the jackdaw's nest back in the year 2000. And the jackdaw had built its nest, Richard, you'll remember, in a chimney. And it started to rain one day. And the female who was kind of keeping the chicks warm because they had already hatched out and regulating their body temperature had opened her wings like an umbrella and put the wings over to keep the birds dry. It was extraordinary to see it.
I remember that, Derek. It was quite an observation to see that in the flesh, having read about it and all that, actually to see it was wonderful. I think there's an element of time management about your blackbird. A bird, or any creature really, has to divide up its time as intelligently as possible. And everything's a trade-off. Time singing is time you can't spend feeding. So if you want to be big, fat and strong, you should feed a lot. If you want to impress ladies and things, you should also sing a lot. But the two contradict each other a bit. Now, in the rain, I suspect the bird says, well, I can feed great after this. The soil will be wet. The worms will come up because the worms will feel the patter of the drops on the surface and they will come up to the surface knowing it's wet up there and they'll be able to get at the detritus. So I suspect there is something like that going on. It can defer feeding because it knows the rain will bring the worms up.
Yes, time management is very important for the birds, especially at this time of year when they have so many hungry mouths to feed. Blackbirds particularly, they're run ragged by their chicks because they have a very interesting breeding strategy. They almost always have two broods, at least here in Ireland. And what happens is that the female obviously will lay the eggs and then the parents will both feed those chicks when they've hatched out. But then when it comes time for those chicks to fledge, which means to leave the nest, dad will look after the first brood while the mother then is incubating the second lot of eggs. So at the moment, a lot of people will be seeing male blackbirds around feeding their chicks. They're wondering where the females are. They seem to have disappeared. They might think that their bad mother is not looking after their chicks. They're already getting ready for the next lot to come along in the next few days or weeks. So it's a very busy time for them. And at the end of the nesting season, so in the next few weeks, you'll see the blackbirds start to look quite ragged. Their feathers get a bit tattier. And then, of course, they may be more prone to the elements. They won't be so keen to be out in the rain then until they've molted their feathers. And that's why so many birds, particularly songbirds, molt their feathers at the end of the breeding season, because just the wear and tear, the toll it's taken going back and forth all day long to feed those chicks and to look after the eggs as well has really damaged their feathers so much that they need to replace them to make sure that they're nice and waterproof and warm then coming into the autumn and then the cold winter months. That's how they survive.
The really mysterious singer is, of course, a close relative of the blackbird, the missel thrush. Now, this bird is also known as the storm cock, because in storms it sings, I'm told. I've never actually heard it do this because it don't be out in storms very much. But apparently when a storm comes, the storm cock goes high in a tree and sings out into the gale. I suppose there's some element of time management in that, but it is a mysterious thing for a missel thrush to do.
It is, and they're often, as you say, at the very highest point they can find. So in a storm, the top of that tree is whipping around the place. It would seem quite dangerous. And I've heard a theory that the pitch of the missel thrush's song is such that actually the sound of the wind, rather than drowning it out like it would for other birds, it actually helps to carry it further and project it over a wider area, which especially at the start of the breeding season would mean that that male missel thrush, because of course it's just the male that sings, which is the case for most of our birds, it may have a better chance then at attracting in a female from a wider radius around. So that's maybe one of the reasons why they do it. It might also be showing off his skills. It's a lot of bravado involved in this. He's showing, I'm tough, I'm healthy, I'm strong, I can handle this storm. So ladies, I'm a very attractive prospect. I can look after myself very well. I have good strong genes. I'd make a good father for any chicks that we might have together. And I can clearly provide well for them because I'm fit and healthy. My territory has lots of food in it. And this is what's being conveyed through these songs. So I find that absolutely magical. Likewise, Richard, I've never actually witnessed the missel thrushes doing that myself in a really harsh storm. I've seen them singing in rain all right, like the blackbirds, but not when it's really blowing a gale. But I believe they do it. They're quite well known for it.
Well, they may be able to sing, but can they dance like Gene Kelly from Singing in the Rain? I bet they can't, but they should learn. Anyway, let's move on. Niall, you were on Rockabilly last week.
I was. Rockabilly Island was a real treat. I got to spend a few days and a few nights out there at Ireland's most important tern colony. So Rockabilly Island, for those who don't know it, it's a very small island, basically a lump of rock. It's off the coast of Skerries in North County Dublin. It's about 6 kilometres offshore. And you access it, we got there is actually by taking a boat out from Malahide. So from your neck of the woods there, Richard. And it's a wonderful place to be. So at this time of year, it's full of thousands of screaming terns. So terns are migrant seabirds, and there are three species of these that nest on Rockabilly Island. We have the common tern, which, as the name suggests, is the most numerous. There's about 2,000 pairs of those out there. There's a few pairs of Arctic terns as well, maybe 50 or 60 pairs of those, and they're mainly nesting on the smaller island called the Bill. So Rockabilly technically is two islands. It's the Rock, which is the big one, which has a lighthouse on it, and then there's the Bill, which is the smaller island, very hard to reach, and that's where the Arctic terns would live. And then we have the most important species there, the roseate tern. So last year there were 1,600 pairs of that. That's Europe's rarest breeding seabird, and Rockabilly is home to what is by far the largest colony of this species in Europe. It's a very interesting species, the roseate tern. It's very beautiful. It's like the other terns, it's a very pale bodied bird, sort of very pale grey, white below. It has a pinkish flush on its chest, which you see at close range. So on Rockabilly, when they're all around you and they're sitting on the walls beside you, you see that pink flush on the chest very well. You don't often get to see that when they're flying further away from you. They have long tails, long forked tails with streamers on them and long pointed wings, which gave them the old name of sea swallow. That's what they were known as by many sailors for centuries. And like the other terns, they have a black cap on top of their head. And the easiest way to distinguish between the three terns that nest on Rockabilly is by the colour of their bills. So the Arctic tern has an all red beak. The common tern has a red beak with a black tip on it. And the roseate tern at this time of year has an all black beak. And then over the next few weeks, as the breeding season goes on, they'll get a bit more red towards the base of the beak, but it'll always be mostly black, or at least half red, half black, never majority red like the other two. And it's amazing there on Rockabilly Island because my colleague, Dr. Stephen Newton, who's looked after this project there with the support of the National Parks and Wildlife Service for many years, he has done wonders for this bird. It went from virtual extinction in Ireland to a very low number to being now a powerhouse for this species. It's basically a roseate tern factory, and the birds that are raised on this island, they then naturally go and recolonise and repopulate other colonies around Europe, particularly Cocot Island in England, the Skerries Islands that are in Wales, there's islands in Brittany, and also then the Azores. There's interchange between Rockabilly and the Azores, which is another very important colony for this species. So it was amazing to see that work up close and personal and to enjoy the sights and sounds and smells of a seabird colony. And I have to say, I thoroughly enjoyed it.
And of course, this is a species and a project that has featured on this programme for many years now, and it's important to keep the pressure on, isn't it?
Oh, it is. We can't be complacent. So it's been a big success. It's been running for over 30 years now, run by Birdwatch Ireland and the National Parks and Wildlife Service. But, something could go wrong. We have to be careful with this. You can't have all your eggs in one basket or on one island. We want to make sure now that Rockabilly can be a source of roseate terns that will then populate other colonies around Europe and indeed in Ireland. We're hoping that more of these birds may colonise the Dalkey Islands, for example. They may then extend to some of the islands in Wales, in Brittany, and also more of them going to the Azores. So we're not going to rest on our laurels. We're going to keep pumping out those roseate terns and making sure that the species is secure.
And this is the time of year they're actually breeding. So did you make a little recording for us with Steve Newton when you were there?
Oh, you know me, Derek, always prepared to do that. I'm not going to miss that opportunity. So I did. I had a chance during a quiet moment to sit down, actually just on the jetty, which is the only relatively quiet place on the island where the terns aren't constantly dive bombing you and pecking at your head. And I chatted with him about the project and what's going on this year.
We've been out a couple of days now. We're in the third week of May and we're in the final stages of project setup really. So on Monday this week we brought out 15 new nest boxes and 2 new hides which had been paid for by the Roseate Tern Life project last year. We've had these things prefabricated, they're a bit like IKEA flat pack kits that we have to then assemble on site. And then, very importantly, secure into the rock so they don't get blown away by storms. So we've had a busy couple of days, mostly working on the hides. We've put out a few boxes yesterday. The terns just started laying, so literally 5 days ago we had the first common tern egg, and the following morning we had 2 single roseate tern eggs. So now, 5 days on, it's getting very busy, lots of 1 and 2 eggs and occasionally even a 3 egg common tern nest. So the birds are very busy. I'm sitting on the pier, lovely sunny afternoon, looking over towards the Bill, the second island, and there we have Arctic tern's beginning to get established, so there's lots of courtship and copulation going on, so it's really interesting, and we look forward to seeing where those Arctic terns will eventually nest, on the bill or on the rock. We've probably got a few on both sites. So, exciting time of year. We've got all our boxes and hides up and secured. We've got a big storm forecast for tomorrow, so the wardens are on high alert during the storm. So this year we have Emma Tiernan back for her third year as a Rockerbill warden, and we have two new guys and girls, one Micheál Fitzgerald from Cork and Alexandra Fink from Munich, surprisingly. So we've got an eclectic team here, a Dub, a Cork and a German, and a guy called Steve Carrington, who comes out here. He's my pally handyman, and he helps me with a lot of the woodwork and plumbing work. So we'll be back in a couple of weeks to hopefully do the final nest census.
That was Steve Newton of Birdwatch Ireland on Rockerbill talking with Niall Hatch. Richard.
Niall, the story brings back a memory, an extraordinary memory. Many years ago, I went on a ringing expedition with Hugh Brazier and Mark Avery to Rockerbill. We brought along with us a stuffed stoat. The idea being that we'd get the chicks all right, but we wanted to catch a few of the adults to put rings on them. So we set up mist nets, that's a spider's web type net, in the mallow, the vegetation there, and put the stoat up on top of a wall, thinking in our foolishness that the terns would see this stoat and they would come in their numbers and get caught in the net and we'd ring them. But no, not a single tern was fooled, although it was a perfectly mounted stoat, yet not a single bird went towards it. Now, the other memory is of the tremendous aggression of terns. Terns, it's not like a gull colony. They swoop at you in a gull colony, but they don't usually hit you. They do occasionally. But the tern will come down on the top of your head and he'll draw blood. And they're very aggressive. But interestingly, I want to ask Niall if he agrees with this. There is a kind of symbiosis here. I believe the roseate tern is less aggressive than the Arctic and the common tern. Now, all three nest together, or rather the roseate, I think, like to nest with common and Arctic terns, because they know that if a fox or whatever, a person comes, an intruder comes, they know that the common and Arctic terns will attack. They don't have to then go to war with the aggressor so much. Is there a kind of symbiosis here, a kind of trade-off?
Yes, Richard, that's absolutely right. And that's why it's so important for a thriving roseate tern colony to have a thriving population of these other more aggressive terns, because they do very much depend on this defence mechanism that the other terns provide. So we know at other colonies in Ireland, so a good example would be at the Dalkey Islands in South County Dublin, we want to encourage roseate terns to nest there because we put out nest boxes for them. We know that they're habituated to using these nest boxes that are placed on the ground on Rockerbill. So we're hoping they'll recognise them and will go to Dalkey and nest there as well. But before that can happen, we need to make sure that there's a secure colony there of Arctic and or common terns that will defend those roseate terns. And roseate terns, it seems, won't actually nest in a colony generally, or won't start nesting in a new place unless those other tern species are present. So there is very much this beneficial effect. What seems to happen as well is that the common and the Arctic terns tolerate the roseate terns quite well. They don't seem to come into conflict with each other. They must be competing for some of the same resources in terms of catching fish for their chicks offshore. But I think that perhaps that, you know, more pairs of eyes looking out for danger would be a benefit there. The roseate terns do seem to be very observant. They're often among the first to flush when danger comes, so they'll fly up when they see the predator, or indeed a human warden walking through the colony. They often tend to be a bit flightier, and they may serve as an early warning system, I suppose, for the other terns. And of course at Rockerbill, even though it's quite a remote island, and it luckily doesn't have any mammalian predators, so there are no mink out there, there are no rats, there are no mice, and that's why it's such a thriving seabird colony. We do still get visits from gulls coming across, and we do also get sometimes daily visits from a peregrine falcon that will fly in and take some of the adult birds or some of the young tern chicks later in the season when they're starting to fly. They're easy pickings. But what happens is when you've got this big critical mass of thousands of terns all squawking and dive bombing, they can drive predators away. They will even try to drive away gulls very effectively, and even peregrines. If they spot them coming in, they'll pick this big cloud up in the sky to try and confuse it and whirl all over the place making lots of noise to try and disorient it, and hopefully then the peregrine will give up and just zoom back to the mainland. So it seems quite effective on Rockerbill, I have to say.
Well, good luck to all the wardens who are stationed out on Rockabill for the season. And we hope that more and more roseate terns breed and hopefully, as Niall has said, colonate more parts of our island and further afield right out into Europe to keep this species alive. Let's say hello now to Dr. Matthew Jebb, Director of the National Botanic Gardens. We were talking about rain earlier, Matthew, with Richard and Niall, and how the birds are affected by rain and what they do in the rain. Is it good for you up there in the Botanic Gardens? Do you like to see the rain, Matthew?
Well, I know, Derek, it's often the case that we're not looking for just hot, dry weather. We're looking for a bit of sun and rain to keep those plants happy.
Matthew, let's start at the very beginning, as they say. So you're still open for business. Have you relaxed your restrictions in there? What's the situation at the National Botanic Gardens?
We have relaxed a little bit. For some months, we've kept the vegetable garden, the rockery, various sort of woodland paths closed because they were narrow and confined. But we've opened all those up now because we feel our visitors are responsible enough to know their limits, to know when they don't want to be in a crowded spot. So it's a chance really to show off the plants, because otherwise you're depriving people of all of that hard work we've done and in getting those plants to a lovely stage of the year.
Well, we're well and truly into spring, almost at the end of spring. We're knocking on the door of summer. So what plants have you got there?
Well, the plant of the moment, of course, is the may tree. The hawthorn trees are in full bloom up and down the country. And traditionally, this is the tree that signifies the beginning of the summer months, a tradition that the may tree signals the first day of the truly good weather, that a frost after the may tree has come out is incredibly unusual. So we can sort of rest comfortable now that the summer season is well underway, and the smell and the scale of the blossom of the hawthorn is a striking sight in every little roadway up and down the country.
And occasionally you see the lone standing hawthorn. There's one in the Phoenix Park near the old armory's fort there, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, the folklore surrounding this tree is massive. It is no doubt that because of its indicator of the summer months, it has acquired folklore not only in Ireland, but really right across the Atlantic seaboard of Europe. The thorn tree is regarded as a sacred tree. It's to do with the fairy realm, and people quite rightly choose to leave these lone trees alone. They're often associated with old wraths and so forth, their spiky nature, the way they make excellent stock-proof fences, often associated with holy wells. And of course, we have the rag tree tradition that, you know, hanging little offerings on these trees goes back way before Christianity. It's something that represents the elder religions of Europe.
There's a fairy triad, if I'm not mistaken. If you have the ash, the oak and the hawthorn together, you're going to see fairies.
That's right. And the big thing about the thorn trees was that they represented that link, that because of that association, it is that the warrior fairies would relax or rest after battles, tending their wounds. And they often lay in the shade of the thorn tree, the may tree.
And is it true that people often would plant them in order to protect slow growers like the oak? Because I know the hawthorn is a fast grower for the first decade or so, isn't it?
This great surge of rewilding across Europe and an understanding of how does forest replace itself. You've got open grassland, and if you've got grazing animals, every little tree that tries to come up will usually get chomped into oblivion. But you get little thickets of thorns and spiny plants, and it's amongst them that the little baby oaks, the birches, the ash trees, they come up inside the protection of the thorns. And so they are part of an ecological cycle, if you like, that woodland can develop in the presence of grazing animals. That kind of mosaic of habitats across Europe is no doubt, you know, one of the founding reasons for a lot of our biodiversity, the mixture we have.
But it seems to me, and I've travelled quite a bit across Europe, that we have more hawthorns per square metre than any other country in Europe. Am I just imagining that?
They disappear in closed forests. Once a forest gets growing, a thorn tree is an early coloniser. It survives well as a hedgerow tree at the edge of forests. But once you've got big oaks and ash, alder, they shade it out and it disappears. So it represents a successional stage that is short-lived, really, and a lot of Europe has a great deal bigger forests than we do here in Ireland. And that's partly a reflection of the ecosystem here. We've got wet boglands that don't harbour big forests, but traditionally we also lost a lot of our forests during clearances over the last 400 or 500 years.
Richard.
Matthew, you raised so many interesting ideas there. I think we could thank the Congested District Board for the large number of hawthorns we have, because when the big estates were divided up, farmers were instructed to fence them off. And of course, the hawthorn is the plant for doing that. You can grow it quickly in a little nursery, and then you can set up all these fences and keep the cattle in. It's thorny, so the cattle won't get through it. It's good from livestock. You mention, however, mythology and so forth. It seems to me the hawthorn is a great fusion of pagan and Christian. Now, the place that comes to mind is Glastonbury, a place I visit occasionally because we have friends living not all that far away. Now, in Glastonbury, Joseph of Arimathea was supposed to have arrived there and stuck his staff into the ground, and it changed into a hawthorn. And the hawthorn blooms twice a year, in May and in December. Now, it was destroyed, the original tree was destroyed in the English Civil War, but they've planted successive ones, cuttings from the original. How is that possible, Matthew? You can't grow it from seed. Is this a kind of an Irish yew situation?
What happens with a lot of these strange mutations in plants, and an example might be the pendulous ash tree. A pendulous ash tree will bear lots of ripe seeds. You can sow them, but they'll all turn into ordinary upright ash trees because the genetic source of the error, if you like, in the plant disappears in the next generation. It gets suppressed. It's a recessive gene. In the case of this thorn tree that flowers twice a year, its name is variety biflorus, meaning it flowers twice a year. And that, again, is an extraordinary mutated form that will go from cuttings, go from graftings. But if you sow the seeds, you get the normal single flowering thorn tree. So it is a typical feature of certain mutations in plants that they won't transmit into the next generation. And if they do, it's usually fatal for the plant. If you have certain genes, the recessive form, having two copies of it, you might say, well, you'll end up with blue eyes, for example, in the case of human eyeballs. But in the case of something more significant to a plant or animal, the two failed genes are actually lethal, and so the plant won't survive. So this is what we see in these strange mutant forms of plants, this inability to be passed through the germline into another seed. But the wonder of plants is you can reproduce them asexually by cuttings and graftings.
You mentioned grafting. Suppose I have hawthorns and one tends to bloom very early. And if I take another one that blooms very late, and I graft the later one onto the first one, would I get a hybrid that will produce both? Or will the genetics of one take over from the other? What would happen?
You would get two things potentially happening. One would be the genetics would hold true in the two branches. However, depending on the trigger for the age of flowering or the date of flowering, this can be hormonal. And so there will be an influence exerted by one form on the other. So potentially all sorts of strange things might happen. But we do know that genetically, plants have a predisposition to flower at a particular moment in the year. So in the past, historically, we have often imported plants from tree nurseries on the continent, particularly Holland, the Netherlands. And these plants have got a genetic predisposition to flower a bit earlier because spring comes earlier in southern Europe and it proceeds like a great wave up towards the northern parts of Europe. So introducing this different genetic lineage of species still found in Ireland and in the continent, we have the risk of imported material flowering too soon for the pollinators to be at work. So it's a consequence of these moves that have big potential to upset ecosystems because the pollinating insects, the insects that depend upon the moment leaves appear on trees, they're all timed in nature to work in synchrony. And therefore, putting in different genetic stock can throw these timings out.
It seems to me, looking at the wonderful white hedges around here now with the maybush, and the lovely smell you get up close, that hawthorn is overdoing it a bit. There's an overkill. It seems to go to great lengths to get pollinated. And it seems impossible that there could be enough insects to get around to even the tiniest fraction of the flowers that are there. Is this a reflection of a decline in insects or something like that? Or is it a statistical thing where you've got to have thousands of flowers just to get one or two pollinated?
The big risk to any flowering tree is the lack of pollinators from bad weather. So if you've got rainy, cold, windy conditions, a lot of these pollinators will not be out and about. And that is why you will see the hawthorn has a succession of flowers. It's opening new flowers every day. They last 3 to 4 days, and it will flower for up to a month. And during that time, pollinators will be in abundance and they may disappear during bad weather. But at the end of the season, a thorn tree will sometimes be absolutely covered. The whole tree looks reddish from a distance because of the abundance of fruit on it. And a thorn tree in full fruit is a fabulous sight to behold. So a good season, if you have a whole month of good pollination going on, the wretched tree actually has a job to grow so many fruits, but it will do it and it will produce a massive crop.
Niall.
The hawthorn, or the white thorn, as many people in Ireland would know it, is one of the most important plants that we have for biodiversity, for birds and for insects especially. So as Matthew said there, it has this amazing berry crop, and that's very important for the birds because the plant will hold those berries sometimes for several months, which means there's a steady food supply for many of the birds at a time of year when it's a lot harder for them to find other food. At this time of year, of course, although the white thorn is flowering, it's also the time of year when we have lots of birds nesting in it, and it makes a great nesting habitat for a wide variety of species because it's so impenetrable to predators. So things like sparrowhawks and foxes and cats, they can't get through those prickles. And so the birds are nice and secure inside there. And of course, as well, what's happening is we have all of those insects around it. A hawthorn plant will support up to 150 different species of insect here. So that's one of the big advantages of our native plants. Our native insects have evolved alongside them. And so you have this abundance of insect life around them. And of course, those insects and their larvae, in turn, they become bird food. We also know that hawthorn hedges, particularly, they're sought out by predators such as barn owls. They actually seek them out because they know that they're going to be little rodents, little mice and shrews and as well, which another type of animal, not a rodent. They be hiding underneath there, and they use them as conduits to get from A to B. So a really vital plant, a very important part of the Irish landscape, and one that, you know, I think we'd be hard-pressed to do without here in Ireland from a biodiversity point of view. It really is that important.
One of the striking features in May is the appearance of the thorn, and this year is an example of quite a late spring, and the thorn tree is able to time its flowering at the appropriate weather conditions, so it's going to bring out its blooms just at the right moment of a lot of these insects hatching, the birds nesting, and it is a wonderful indicator, if you like, of how the natural ecosystem times itself depending on whether the spring is early or late. And the smell that Richard was talking about earlier, it is very overpowering at times, almost a sickly sweet smell, but you can see how that is going to be really attractive to bring in the pollinators.
Speaking of pollinators, Matthew, stay there if you would. We're going to say hello now to Professor Francis Ratniacs from the University of Sussex. He's been on the programme before, so he knows the formula. And he's here to tell us about research carried out last summer into why some plant species attract bumblebees and others attract honeybees while foraging. What's going on? Francis Ratniacs, welcome to the programme. Tell us more, please.
Well, yes, the study we did was on insects, honeybees and bumblebees, visiting flowers of different species to collect nectar. And so nectar is expensive to produce. It's got a lot of energy in it. And plants often make quite small quantities of nectar. And indeed, the time of year that we did the study, which was the summer, really there is quite a significant nectar shortage. People think the summer's a great time for bees, but actually there's a lot of insects chasing a relatively small amount of nectar.
And is the plant using that to control which insects come? You say that, for instance, bumblebees are much heavier, need a lot more energy, and so on and so forth. Does the plant reduce its supply of nectar in order to ensure that a bee has to come and visit many flowers to get enough nectar?
It's possible, but I'm not sure if we've really shown that. Obviously, flowers don't have to produce huge amounts of nectar to attract the insects. They presumably have to produce a certain amount to get the insects to visit, but they don't have to overproduce. Like if you were running a business and you wanted to get staff to work for you, you wouldn't have to give them €1,000 an hour. You know, you could give a much more modest salary than that. You'd still have plenty of people queuing up for the job.
Yes, but I don't just want to get them to come and collect pollen. I want them to go elsewhere, to another plant. So I'm doing two things. I want them to come in, give them a taste, and then this will encourage them to go off to another plant, maybe a distance away. Is this the sort of model we're looking at?
Well, the average bee might have to visit hundreds, if not 1,000 flowers to get a full load before it returns back to its nest. So flowers certainly would be pretty stupid if they made so much nectar per flower that the bee only had to sort of visit one flower, because the idea is, of course, for pollination that the pollinating bee needs to visit a number of flowers.
Well, now you look at it from the bee's point of view. It has to expend energy. It has to pay out in order to go around and collect nectar from plants. It could either go very often to plants near, or it could go less often to plants farther away. Now, if it does the plants farther away deal, it's going to have to be a lot lighter, because it's going to be more expensive to do that than to flit between plants that are close together. It can be heavy and get to nearby plants, but I can't be heavy, I want to get a distance away.
Well, the study we did, we weren't looking at, if you like, the commute of the bee from the nest or the hive to the flowers. The bees were travelling very short distances from flower to flower when we actually studied them. But in the grand scheme of things, of course, the bee is expending energy going from flower to flower, which is what we studied, but also expend additional energy in going from the nest to, let's say, the flower patch. And bees can travel long distances. Honeybees will travel even as far as 10 or 12 kilometres from the hive to the flower patch. But under normal circumstances, they don't go nearly that far. But routinely, they will travel 1 or 2 kilometres from the hive to the patch of flowers. And bumblebees will travel similar distances.
In other words, if a plant is sporadically distributed far apart, it will appeal to the honeybee as the ideal pollinator. Whereas if it's close together, if there are many such plants close by, it would seem to dictate attendance by bumblebees. That might be a sort of... Bumblebees apparently go more quickly, more frequently to collect, and they need more nectar to drive them, and therefore they will collect more pollen and so on. And so forth. So it's a kind of Concorde versus jumbo transport, you know, whether to go to Sussex by plane or to go there by what we used to call boat and train long ago. Is that the kind of dichotomy the insects face?
Well, not perhaps that extreme. Yeah, the bumblebees basically are approximately twice as heavy as the honeybees, and they use twice as much energy to go about their foraging. So the difference is between, say, a car with a 2.5 litre motor versus a 1500cc motor. But of course, the faster car, the bumblebee, can visit more flowers in a given amount of time. So it's a matter of degree. It's not quite as extreme as taking the boat from Britain to Ireland versus the plane from Britain to Ireland.
Well, now, if I'm a plant, therefore I will have a preference. Surely the plants then arrange their flowers to induce the particular kind they want and exclude the others. Is this the kind of selection that's taking place out there?
In our study, we studied plants which were visited both by honeybees and bumblebees, and indeed some other insects, although the bumblebees and honeybees were 96% of all the insects that were visiting the flowers that we studied. There are some flowers, for example, comfrey would be one, a fairly common flower in Ireland, which you won't see honeybees on it because the flower is so deep that the honeybee can't access the nectar. It doesn't have a long enough tongue. So there are some flowers which, you know, for example, a honeybee can't visit at all, but a bumblebee might be able to. But we didn't study those because it wouldn't have kind of been interesting to do so. We wanted to know, given that both honeybees and bumblebees could visit the flowers that we were studying, so there wasn't like one couldn't do it at all, we were trying to understand why some of the species had, for example, 95% bumblebees and 5% honeybees, or the reverse.
I think, Francis, that is one of the most sort of exciting shifts that your research has revealed, because just like you say, when Charles Darwin started looking at pollination syndromes, we have always been brought up on this idea that structurally different flowers present in different ways. And I was fascinated by the fact that the length of tongues was almost insignificant compared to this foraging efficiency, like you say, that the bees are, in a sense, in competition with one another. And that it gives us a completely different view of how the ecology of pollination is carrying on.
Yes, I would agree with what you say, Matthew. People have sometimes focused or thought about, you know, the reason that this flower's got mostly honeybees and this has got mostly bumblebees is to do with, say, the depth of the flower. But in our study, we found that this was really not an important, or as we say, not significant, whereas the energy was. So in some cases, on some species of flowers, the honeybees could forage more efficiently, and in others, the bumblebees. And that efficiency, that energetic efficiency, explained almost everything we needed to know about why some flower species had mostly honeybees and some mostly bumblebees. And indeed, we humans are used to the fact that energy matters. You know, we fill up our car or pay our electricity bills or think about where we're going to generate our electricity in the future. You know, energy is a fundamental thing that humans worry about. And it's also a fundamental thing that animals, and especially bees, worry about.
Like you say, it is a big shift in our understanding, I think, your research has revealed, which is wonderful. And one of the great pleasures of science is where suddenly something is upended like this, simply through observation. You know, the science behind it is just a lot of observation and then coming up with a wonderful new idea like you have, that there is a complicated ecology, because I know you did a lot of experiments with pairing up different plants together, but that whole influence of how the two bee groups are in competition, but somehow they can be very quick at calculating what is the best foraging behaviour for them to suddenly undertake.
Well, bees really do know how much they're getting paid. And if they're not getting paid enough, they'll go elsewhere. So yeah. Underlying all of this is that the bees do have choices. It's not as though there's only one species of plant in bloom and that's it. There are many species of flowers in bloom in any one location. So the bees do have choices. And what fundamentally affects the bees, say the honeybees, is what the bumblebees are doing and vice versa. So if the bumblebees are very efficient on one species of flower, they'll kind of deplete the nectar levels down to a point at which it's not worthwhile for the honeybees to bother, and vice versa.
The basic running cost, Francis, of a bumblebee versus that of a honeybee. The bumblebee is bigger and heavier. Is there a payoff here? Does if he's flitting about an awful lot, the bumblebee is moving a lot, he's visiting flowers at a tremendous rate, the honeybee seems to be more laid back, takes a more leisurely pace. Is the running cost per gram lower for the honeybee than it would be for a bumblebee overall to start with?
No, it's not. The running cost of a honeybee and a bumblebee per gram of bee is identical. physiologists have published many, many studies. They've done many research projects, you know, looking at how much it costs for a bumblebee to fly or walk, or a honeybee to fly and walk. And it turns out that gram for gram, it's identical. The reason bumblebees cost more to run is not because they're less efficient or they use more energy per gram of bee. It's just that they are heavier. Indeed, in our study, on average, the bumblebees were 1.85 times as heavy as the honeybees. So that's not so good for them. But they visited flowers at 1.86 times the rate. So kind of like the swings and roundabouts on average were exactly balanced. But they weren't exactly balanced per species of flower. So on some species of flowers, the honeybees had an advantage, and on some, the bumblebees. And one species that you'll be very familiar with in Ireland is heather, you know, which covers the hills and so on. And this is the only species of flower that we found where the honeybees were actually quicker than the bumblebees. And it's probably because heather has tiny little flowers on it, and the sort of rather big bumblebees weren't as well suited. And that kind of come out in the wash, as you might say, in energy efficiency. You know, on Calluna vulgaris, the common heather or ling, bumblebees just weren't very efficient. They were big and slow, whereas on most flowers, they're big and fast.
And also, these bees must have to make a quick decision when they land on a flower and discover somebody's already drunk all the nectar away. They need to quickly move on. But are bees able to actually tell from a distance or by pheromones whether a flower has been recently visited?
There is some evidence that they can avoid a flower which has been recently visited. But when bees are foraging, they're not really visiting just one flower, they're visiting hundreds. So the question is more, what's the average energy gain from foraging on that species of flowers in that patch? So, you know, typically, you know, you go into the countryside and your garden is a patch of a certain species of flower. There might be hundreds or even thousands of flowers, and a bee will typically work it for a period of time. But you also see a bee will show up in a patch of flowers, visit three or four flowers, and then it'll buzz off. So presumably the bee has made a quick sample, it's figured out within about a minute that it's not worth bothering, and off it goes. But when we did our study, we were studying bees that were kind of consistently foraging in the patch, because we had to follow each bee for a minute. And very roughly, in a minute, a honeybee will visit 10 flowers and a bumblebee will visit 15 or 20. That's not exact, but that's roughly what we're talking about.
It is amazing that you have revealed, if you like, something that's been hidden before our eyes, because it is, I think, a whole new way that we can now appreciate what is going on. And with the popularity of pollination borders, that people are growing a lot more flowers with good nectar and pollen supplies, that people can sort of view it as a very different light now, that there's an ecological balance of getting the right energy level efficiency from your time and motion study of all these little bees.
Yeah, well, you know, if bees are good at doing one thing, it's foraging. They've been collecting nectar for 100 million years approximately, so they've got pretty good at it. But there is one very interesting sort of take-home message or result from our study, and that's people often worry about bee conservation. You know, for example, are the honeybees harming the bumblebees or vice versa? But what we've kind of shown is that the honeybees and the bumblebees are not competing head-on. They're both collecting nectar, sure, but the honeybee has an inbuilt advantage on some flower species, and the bumblebees have an inbuilt advantage on others. So actually, given that at any given time there are many species of flowers in bloom, we don't really have to worry too much about are there too many honeybees, are there too many bumblebees, because they've each got their kind of advantage on particular species. They're not competing head on, is perhaps the best way to look at it.
Francis, in your analysis of energy versus input-output, you maintained that both the bumblebee and the honeybee have the same usage, the same requirement. They need the same amount of nectar for the same amount of mass to carry them around. Now, if I'm coming from Ireland, of course, you're very conscious of the weather. Now, the striking thing about honeybees versus bumblebees to an outsider such as myself is that the honeybee is naked, so therefore it's likely to lose energy heat to the environment much more so than the bumble. The bumble is well insulated and he's larger, so he should be able to weather adverse conditions much better than the honeybee. Now, is this kind of thing a factor? Is the weather a factor? Does it dictate what's going on to some extent?
Well, we're also doing research on that, but in this particular project, we weren't studying the bees under conditions which were, say, adequate for bumblebees but too cold for honeybees. Those conditions do exist, and if you get up in the morning and go into your garden in Britain and Ireland the same, you may find that you don't see honeybees on the flowers because it's still a little bit cool, because the bumblebees can forage at lower temperatures than the honeybees because they can sort of conserve their body heat better, that the heat that they generate from flying. But in this particular project, we weren't sort of affected by that possibility because we only looked at our bees, if you like, when it was warm enough so that there were no kind of difficulties for the honeybee. Or equally, it was never hot enough that the bumblebees were overheating and the honeybees weren't. So we weren't really affected by that.
Francis, now that you have all of this information, what do you do with it? How is this going to help the honeybee or the bumblebee? Or how is this going to help us better understand them? Are we going to have to plant different plants in different places? Or what do we do now? I ask you as a layperson.
We can stop worrying, actually. That's one thing. Because, I mean, it's wonderful that so many people are interested in bees, honeybees, bumblebees, all kinds of bees in Ireland and Britain, around the whole world. But sometimes people get a little bit sort of over worried about certain things. For example, that the beekeepers are kind of keeping too many hives and it will harm bumblebees or other species. But because our research shows that the bumblebees and honeybees are not competing head on, it kind of means that it'd be unlikely that the honeybees would be harming the bumblebees or vice versa. And also, as long as we continue to have an abundant supply of flowers and of many different species, I think that the bees will each find their own little niche, if you like. The honeybees and the bumblebees both collect nectar, but they're not taking advantage of the flowers in quite the same way. The honeybees are very good on the heather, the bumblebees are very good on the lavender, and so on.
So there's no big battle between them?
No, because they each have their own flower species that they are a superior competitor. We can think of honeybees and bumblebees and indeed many other insects as competing for the nectar, but they're not competing on a totally even playing field. Some parts of the playing field make it easier for the bumblebees to be the superior competitor. Some parts of the playing field allow the honeybees to be the superior competitor. And across the whole playing field, there's kind of no winner.
Francis, thank you very much indeed.
It's a pleasure. And lovely to talk to people from Ireland, where I spent many happy years. Goodbye.
What a lovely man. I just love the sound of his voice. Now, just before we go, Matthew Jebb, let's talk about the RTE iNature Wildlife Photography Competition, which was a huge success at the beginning of this year. We had the exhibition of the 12 finalists in the Botanic Gardens. It opened on the 17th of March, St. Patrick's Day this year. It's now closed. It's all gathered up and it's on the move. Where is it going to next, Matthew?
This very week it is being set up in Portumna Castle for most of the summer. So it's a great opportunity to see the winning entries in another OPW site.
Fantastic stuff. And again, entry is free. Matthew, thank you very much indeed. Thanks also to Niall Hatch and Richard Collins. Our broadcast coordinator is Jarlath Holland and our researcher is John Bell O'Reilly. Until we talk to you next Sunday, live on RTE Radio 1 from 6 p.m., goodbye.
Thanks.